Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. Woodrow Wilson, the professor turned president and a very complicated figure in American history. He campaigned to be a domestic policy president and later in favor of neutrality, but ended up a wartime president. World War I is a fascinating moment in the history and the evolution of the American presidency, and Wilson is at the heart of that. Today, we're going to be talking with Andrew Phillips, curator of the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library in Stanton, Virginia. And this will be the first of several interviews as we examine Wilson's presidency and World War I. Today's discussion will trace Wilson's meteoric rise from his days as a professor to his political career and his vision of the role of the American president. Future podcasts will focus on Wilson during World War I and then Wilson in the aftermath of the war. Welcome, Andrew, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So start us off with a biographical sketch of Woodrow Wilson leading up to his time at Princeton.
Well, Wilson is born in the lovely city of Stanton, Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley, where the presidential library is located. He lives here for all of about 16 months. We're milking that for all we can. And then moves on with his family to live in Augusta, Georgia, Columbia, South Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina. He's really moving quite frequently as a child and a young man until he settles eventually at Princeton University as a student. He loves Princeton in a way I think he doesn't love other places. Loves the university. Then it's the College of New Jersey, but loves the town as well. He leaves Princeton after graduation. He tries to become a lawyer. This is when he is briefly returns to Virginia, except for his 16-ish months living in Stanton as a baby. He spends about a year at UVA in law school and then never lives in the state again, though always has a very strong connection to Virginia. But he lives in Georgia briefly, where he is a lawyer and hates it. He meets his first wife, so it's not all bad, and then eventually returns to Princeton as a professor and then later president of that university.
When do you think he decides that he wants to enter politics? Because, I mean, the beginning of his life, he's clearly an academic. So when does that desire emerge?
Well, I think that was fairly innate sort of in him. When he's about 10 years old, he makes a constitution for the local boys group baseball team. It's a bunch of his friends. And he like writes out this document that says you will be fined X amount of cents if you are late to practice and X amount of cents if you curse. So he has a government inclination early on. But it's not really, I think, until he embarks on that attempt at a law career that he's really actively thinking that maybe politics is something he could do. He doesn't have any real connection to the law. He doesn't really like studying the law or even ultimately being a lawyer. But he views the law as the stepping stone to future political office. It's around that time that he's at UVA that we have essentially a doodle. He makes himself a calling card where he lists out his full name, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, Senator from Virginia. I mean, it seems like this was a goal of his as a young man. But as he finds the law distasteful, when he ultimately gets his PhD at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, it does seem like he is moving away from a political career and instead into an academic one where he is going to study politics. He studies U.S. history, writes books on the subject, on how the U.S. government works compared to other governments. And it's not until he is towards the end of his time as president of Princeton, he becomes president of that university in 1902. It's not until later on, honestly, when he has suffered a couple of defeats at the hands of his board and especially that he really starts to think that politics might be his way forward.
Now, when we think of him, we talk about him as a progressive with a capital P. What does that mean in the context of the 20th century?
So the broad progressive movement of this era is a result of huge changes in the United States. The country is becoming more urban, more industrial. There are immigrants coming from all over the world, and people want their government to listen to them in a way that it really never had before. The movement has lots of different parts, and there are quote-unquote progressives who only ascribe to some and not others. But the broader movement usually includes things like women's suffrage and votes for women, the calls to rein in big business, the trusts especially, more protections for workers, ends to things like child labor, and also sometimes prohibition of alcohol is also included in that movement. But the thing that sort of ties a lot of it together is tackling government corruption and making the government be more responsible to the people. And this usually comes through advocating for direct elections for like U.S. senators, who at this point are mostly still chosen by state legislatures, or like primaries, instituting primaries rather than just party conventions that would decide everything. The people get to have a say in who the party would ultimately put forward in the formal election. It's also, though, important to note that for progressives, for white progressives, this often also includes segregation. In the South and in the North, the idea of keeping the races separate, and this almost always is focused on African Americans, is viewed as a progressive idea, or one that is acceptable, or at least not distasteful to other progressive in the movement. But I mean, like today, calling yourself a progressive means different things to different people. And for Wilson, it meant that he was very much supporting an end to child labor, food standard productions of standards for food production, or safety for factory workers. And he was a big proponent of things like direct elections and primaries. He supported stuff like suffrage, but he personally supported a woman's right to vote, but he thought it needs to be a state by state thing. It shouldn't be a national constitutional amendment, which, not surprisingly, was not a popular way to be talking about suffrage. He also, though, was as his presidency really shows, his brand of progressivism ultimately does lead to a marked deterioration in civil rights, especially for like Black civil servants in D.C., but not limited, unfortunately, to them.
You mentioned a little earlier that being a progressive at this time means different things to different people. When I think about it, I think, you've got people like Theodore Roosevelt, who's a progressive. You've got Wilson, who's a progressive, completely different political parties, right? So it's obviously a very kind of broad mm-hmm. movement. Is Wilson a Republican or a Democrat?
Wilson is a progressive Democrat. He is coming from the South. Not too surprisingly, the South is very solidly Democratic Party at this time. In its function, it is not small d Democratic, because so many are denied basic civil rights and basic voting rights. But Wilson and his I think childhood in the South help him to identify primarily with the Democratic Party. And when he runs for governor of New Jersey in 1910, that's the party that he runs on.
Can you describe his path from being university president to becoming governor of New Jersey?
So Wilson is a scholar and author of American history and American politics. He has written a number of books, both academic works that are for like college classes, but also fairly popular ones that are read broadly. And he's a popular lecturer on those subjects. And when the Democratic Party bosses, the machine, is looking for a candidate for the 1910 governor's election in New Jersey, they see Wilson as a good option. He has he's not famous, but he has some name recognition, especially in the state. And they also view him as politically naive, that he would be hopefully easy for them to control. And this is, he states, Wilson states later that he waited for the party bosses to come to him. He was not, this was a time when campaigning was very rarely done by the person actually trying to get the office. It was viewed as vulgar or crass maybe. And you waited for people to come to you so that you could explain your views and then they could understand why they should vote for you, that sort of thing. And Wilson goes into detail saying, when the bosses came to me, I never promised them anything. He was very trying to be very high-minded, I think, about it. But I think it's also very clear that he was more than a little interested in the job. But when they actually get him in office, it turns out it's not exactly what the party bosses were hoping for.
So as governor, even though he had the party bosses' support, he's pretty independent in how he exercises power?
He is. I mean, he tries to show fairly early on that he is not beholden to that party machine. And one of the first breaks is that one of those bosses, one of the ones who came to him and encouraged him to run for governor, a man named James Smith. This is, again, back when senators are chosen primarily by the legislatures. And Wilson didn't support him, didn't support Smith to be appointed senator from New Jersey. They had had there was a primary at the time, but it was one of those things that it was so new that there wouldn't have been a lot of uproar if the legislature decided to ignore the primary. The primary wasn't a formal thing. It was this is what the people think. We hope that the legislature will do the thing we want. And so he supported the candidate who won the primary, who was not Smith. And this got a lot of attention nationally, even. There's a cover of Harper's Weekly from this era as a political cartoon of Wilson with his sleeves rolled up, and he is scrubbing the grime off of the state seal of New Jersey. New Jersey was viewed as one of the most corrupt states in this era, and considering how corrupt every state at the time was, that's kind of saying something. But he is making a very clear stance against that sort of machine politics. And he doesn't ultimately get all the stuff he wants, certainly. He gets a lot of pushback from the legislature, even those other Democrats aren't necessarily always progressives. And I think eventually the Republicans take over control of the chambers. But he does get things like he establishes free dental clinics in the state, and he puts restrictions on the amount of hours that railroad workers can be forced to work. He standardizes training for nurses and restricts child labor in the state as well.
When is he identified as the Democratic candidate for the 1912 election? And can you describe his path to the White House?
His New Jersey achievements get a fair amount of national attention, not just the battle he has with the party bosses, but just it's like this is what progressives can do when they're in power in a state. As early as 1911, there are Wilson clubs popping up around the country. This was one of the ways that people could show their support for a candidate in this. There were primaries back then, but it was not the primary and caucus system that we have today, certainly. But white Southerners especially looked to Wilson and saw sort of an ideal candidate. He has Southern roots. His wife is from Georgia, but he was transplanted to the Northeast and has made his name in the North. They see him as potentially someone who could have a lot of cross-regional appeal. And it's also a time, again, that people are not running for offices themselves. So Wilson is not showing up, you know, in Ohio at the state fair in Iowa at the state fair. But he is behind the scenes creating sort of campaign infrastructure. The press, like no matter where he goes, the press will ask him, oh, are you running for president? Are you interested in running for president in 1912? And he will always tell them no, even until up into 1912. It must have been a lovely time back then when presidential campaigns only lasted like a few months before the actual election. But he is constantly telling them no. But as early as mid-1911, he is starting that architecture and has a couple of people who are part of his quote-unquote campaign who are going around the country and talking to other prominent Democrats, trying to get their support and sound them out for a Wilson run in the primaries. There's only about a dozen primaries back then again, but it's but really at the convention, which is going to be in Baltimore in that summer. That was a very common tactic, and it really works. I mean, Wilson, of those dozen primaries, Wilson wins, I think it's 10 of them. He wins or comes in second in 10 of them. There's only two that he's like totally shut out. But it's still, the decision is still made at the convention. And so at the 1912 convention in Baltimore, Democratic convention in Baltimore, he is one of the most prominent candidates. He doesn't lead in the balloting for a while, but and it ultimately takes 46 votes before he is selected. It was a long process and one that Wilson wasn't present for. Do you not run for president, you usually aren't there campaigning even at the convention for yourself. He's just hanging out in New Jersey and then gets the results by telegram mostly. But he is spending quite a lot of time there and eventually is figuring out how to run for president. And the 1912 election is certainly no less crowded than the dozen or so candidates who were vying for just the Democratic nomination.
Can you tell us a little bit about that 1912 election? I think that's probably one of the most fascinating ones that we've ever had.
Sure. So the Democrats are united in that election behind Woodrow Wilson, but the Republicans split. Their convention in Chicago nominates William Howard Taft, the sitting president, but Theodore Roosevelt walks out. He had been trying to get the nomination again. He had been, unlike pretty much anybody else, he is actively campaigning for himself. And he and a lot of the progressives of the Republican Party walk out. And I think it's about a week later, it's very quickly thereafter, and in the same place, in the same convention center in Chicago, they hold the Progressive Party, something we usually now think of as the Bull Moose Party convention. They nominate Roosevelt to run for office, and he starts actively campaigning all around the country. In the end, Wilson is victorious. The reason I'm sitting here at all, he does win that 1912 election, and it's an electoral landslide. He wins, I think it's like 40 states and more than 400 electoral votes. Theodore Roosevelt wins, I believe it's 6, and Taft only wins 2. I think it's Utah and Vermont. But the vote totals tell a very different story. Wilson becomes president in 1912 with like just under 42% of the popular vote. I think both Roosevelt and Taft are in the mid-20s, with Roosevelt a little above Taft. But then the Socialist Party under Eugene Debs wins 6% of the vote. And this is the best that a Socialist Party has ever done in American elections, presidential elections. But the 1912 election is also really interesting because African-American leaders, men like W.E.B. Du Bois and William Trotter and Booker T. Washington, endorsed Woodrow Wilson. They are concerned, rightly, I think so, when both Roosevelt and Taft, in having split the party, they both are like, where are we going to find more voters? And both start courting Southern whites. And this leads those Black leaders to think, are we going to just be sort of shunted aside? They think that our vote is guaranteed, so they can safely ignore us. And so they have conversations with Wilson and they report back. I don't know exactly what was said, but they report back that Wilson has promised them that he will not seek to damage civil rights, that he will not try to do anything that will diminish the hard-won rights that had already been achieved. And while most African-Americans in the United States are still living in the South in this era, Wilson does win a significant portion of the Black vote, though they will be very quickly disappointed, and Wilson will, betrays those things that they said that he had promised them very quickly in his first term.
I just think it's such an interesting election, and I always think of historical what ifs. What would America's participation in World War I have looked like had it been Roosevelt, had it been Taft, and not Wilson? A what if, but interesting to think
about. Sure. I mean, I wonder, I think if Roosevelt is president, we are in the war much, much quicker.
I think so.
But I mean, I also wonder, I mean, when you just look at the numbers, it seems obvious that, oh, if Taft and Roosevelt had been one candidate, if it had been one or the other of them, that they would have beaten Wilson easily. But I think Wilson had a lot of the progressive energy behind him. And if it was Taft, he probably would have just picked up a lot of those voters that might have gone to Roosevelt. If it was Roosevelt versus Wilson, I think that's a harder question. But I think we also don't. There was a significant backlash to Roosevelt running at all because he had promised during his second term. You know, he becomes president during after McKinley is assassinated, so he doesn't have two full terms. But he claims in his second term that, no, I'm not going to run again. I'm not going to do that. Plus, there's the whole precedent of George Washington. That's kind of a hard wall to break. And so when he's running in 1912, there's more than a few people going, you said you weren't going to do this. there were a few, more than a few folks who were not especially pleased that Roosevelt was running. But it is a fascinating question about what might have happened, for sure. I would have had a job somewhere else. That's for sure.
Now, as an academic, Wilson, you mentioned he wrote about the U.S. government. And in some of his writing, he makes the case that the executive, the president, was too weak. How does this play into his approach to the presidency?
Wilson definitely believed that parliamentary government, like in the U.K., was superior to the presidential congressional style in the United States. He is elected, obviously, president, but he acts like a prime minister in a lot of ways. It's what I think is really the job that he wanted, but American prime minister was not, you know, an option. And he takes a very active role in a way very few other presidents have in not only sort of proposing policy and then hoping that Congress does something or like occasionally whipping votes, but there is an office in the U.S. Capitol that is set aside as the president's office. And usually, and this is even true today, it's used a handful of times a year, and it's mostly for like ceremonial bill signings and things. Wilson used it as an office, and he is there very frequently. He is actively working to craft legislation. He is having meetings with the different congressmen and senators about what their objections are and working to compromise with them. And so he takes a really active role in formulating policy beyond just the, and putting it into practice, beyond just the ideas, the broad ideas of it. And this is effective. I mean, to be more than fair, he has Democratic majorities in both houses. That helps a lot. But he is able to win major legislative victories, like creating the Federal Reserve and the 8-hour workday. There is a ban on child labor that's passed, though unfortunately that is overturned ultimately by the Supreme Court. But he creates the federal farm loan system and the National Park Service and the Federal Trade Commission. And he appoints three Supreme Court justices. And his second one, Louis Brandeis, is the very first Jewish Supreme Court justice in American history. And I also think it's kind of funny, but we think about Theodore Roosevelt as the trust buster. But Wilson, especially in his first term, busts more trusts than Roosevelt did in his presidency. The dark side, of course, of that is a lot of that Democratic power in the Congress, House and Senate, is coming from Southern Democrats. And they come to Washington and come into power with demands for a segregation of the federal workforce. Segregation, Jim Crow has been growing and becoming more solid across the South since the end of Reconstruction. And Plessy versus Ferguson, the separate but equal case, is just about 16 years prior to this. And so people are viewing this as an acceptable and maybe even preferable way of dealing with race relations. And Wilson is the first Southern-born U.S. president elected since the Civil War. Five of his 10 cabinet secretaries are Southern. And when one of the demands of the Southern congressmen is like, okay, because a lot of them are not necessarily progressive. A lot of them are conservative Democrats. And they are like, we'll support, you know, these progressive things that you want to do. That's fine. But this is something that we want in return. And I don't want to give, I don't want it to sound like I'm giving Wilson a pass, like he was forced into this. He is a supporter of this policy. It fits right in with Wilson's paternalistic racism, the way he views his sort of paternalistic view of the world. And he allows his Secretary of the Treasury and the Navy and Postmaster General to pretty quickly in 1913 fully segregate their departments. And especially in Washington itself, these are, there was a growing and thriving Black middle class. These were built on these government jobs. They paid well. They required education. They were stable. They helped to helped by institutions like Howard University in D.C. This was a great example of what African Americans could do when given any sort of chance. And all of a sudden, they are told they are keeping the same jobs, that you're still going to be a clerk, but you have a different bathroom now. You can't be having a different cafeteria now. There was a lot of fear, especially by these Southern congressmen, that there should be no instance of an African-American man who has any sort of control over or supervisory role even over white women. And there were a lot of women working in these departments, too. And so it's the other side of that, of Wilson's progressive coin. He is achieving these legislative goals because, and in a small part, you know, because of his acceptance of segregation. And he's certainly not, I don't want it to either sound like that once this is in place, he's just like, oh, it's too bad, but you know, this is the what they need. He, in numerous meetings, there's not surprisingly quite a bit of protest from Black people, but also from their handful of white allies. And I think it's especially telling the way that Wilson deals with those protests. When he has a meeting in the White House with Oswald Villard, who is the grandson, I believe, of William Lloyd Garrison, who's a very prominent abolitionist. Oswald is a white guy, and he's also one of the founders of the NAACP. Wilson is polite to him, but he gives these, I think the best way to describe it is Wilson is clearly uncomfortable and is kind of weaselly. I mean, he's like, oh no, it's, you know, it's to help them. These are the sort of things. It's not so bad. It's being portrayed wrong. It's really all being overblown. But not long after, he has another meeting, also in the White House, with William Monroe Trotter. And he was a Black newspaper editor out of Boston. And he leads a delegation of other Black leaders to the White House to meet with Wilson. And in that meeting, Wilson is not uncomfortable and weaselly. He is irate. He is angry. He is combative and ultimately throws them out. He blames it on Trotter's tone, but it's a quote unquote tone. But in reading the accounts of both of those different meetings, Villard and Trotter are making very similar arguments about why segregation is not helpful, why it is detrimental, why it is hurting people, and are passionate about this. But in the one, Wilson takes that passion as, and it makes him squirm in his chair. And in the other, he gets irate and kicks them out. I think that really helps to illustrate how Wilson is viewing this issue.
Seems to happen with the suffragettes as well, too. You know, absolutely. There's only so much, I don't want to say criticism, but I think he is very conscious of the tone that people take with the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty clear, especially in those suffragette meetings.
Yes. But Wilson gets a reputation of being really thin-skinned, and I would say it's not as warranted It's not like he was always taking offense at things, but I think partially perhaps his academic background, or just, you know, his personality, when he felt like, I've thought about this thing a lot, and I have heard different views, and I have come to a decision, and now I'm done getting input. And so when he continues to get pushback on things that people disagree with, he gets obstinate about it. This is, I suppose we'll talk about in a future program, how this is really affected by his health. But in his first term, that is still very much the case. He is, and with the suffrage example, I mean, he is in favor of the idea, but doesn't appreciate when people are like, no, we want this. We want this for the whole nation. We don't want to wait and have it be that everyone can vote, but South Carolina still says women can't. He doesn't appreciate, again, that sort of pushback to what he thinks has been very carefully reasoned in his in his mind.
That's a really fascinating read. Again, the professor president, that makes a lot of sense, I think. So tell us about the challenges that he faces in office prior to the outbreak of World War I.
So Wilson faces political and personal challenges. He has the typical opposition, that any president deals with. The other party is not just going to go along with all the stuff you say. And there's a fair amount of resistance from Democrats, too. They are not all in lockstep. Strikes, the most important, I think, in this sort of the first couple of years prior to the war breaking out of his term, the coal strikes in Colorado, and Wilson ultimately will send federal troops in to intervene in that strike, and that is a big point. He's doing a lot of stuff for labor, but there are some things that he is very much not doing for labor, and he is also, again, receiving more than a little bit of resistance and protest from the segregation policies of his government. But on the personal note, and I think most relevant considering how close it was to the actual declaration of World War I at the end of July of 14, is that his wife, Ellen Axon Wilson, is very sick. She has what was then called Bright's disease, but what we now call chronic or acute nephritis. It's a kidney disorder. And unfortunately, one of the things that now can be treated fairly well. But back then, by the time they could detect, by the time they could tell what it was, there was not much else. There was not much to do. And so her condition deteriorates rapidly in the spring and summer of 1914. And she also is telling the presidential physician, the White House physician, Dr. Carrie Grayson, who will come up in our story a little bit later. She is telling him, don't tell my husband how serious this is. He knows, and she knows, that she is dying, but she does not want to be burdening her husband with that knowledge, especially following the assassination of the Archduke in Sarajevo. And so it's only a few days before her death, I believe it's August 6th, that she dies. And Wilson is certainly devastated, and he falls into a dark depression at the exact same time that the world is catching on fire. Certainly no good time to lose a spouse ever. But Wilson loses his wife at this critical time was, I'm sure, more than a little distracting to him.
Obviously, the situation with his wife is very, very distressing, kind of in the months leading up to the actual outbreak of the war. Prior to that, Wilson had been fairly successful in avoiding a major conflict with Mexico. Do you think that gave him confidence that he could avoid entanglement in a European war as well?
I think a lot of his confidence in being able to stay out of the war was more about the oceans. The United States had been able to sit out European conflicts, old world, shall we say, conflicts for most of its history, with, you know, important exceptions like, you know, 1812 and the burning of the White House. Because the Atlantic and then when we reach the West Coast, the Pacific form very effective moats, to European, especially ambition. And it's, I think it's in It's in August of 1914, so the war has begun. But one of the advisors to Wilson writes, again and ever, I thank heaven for the Atlantic Ocean. And Wilson is hardly alone in not wanting to be a part of this war and thinking that we, the United States, need to sit out. I think the American attitude that summer is kind of, this fight is on the other side of the ocean and it's not our problem. With Mexico, on the other hand, you know, it's right next door. And so that is a much more pressing issue for Wilson and for the American people. And the Mexican Revolution has been going on since 1910. I mean, it precedes Wilson's presidency. But by the time that he's in the White House, Victoriano Huerta is the biggest leader of Mexico. He's sitting in Mexico City, at the very least. And he had led a coup against the previous government. And Wilson is able to avoid sort of a full-scale war with Mexico, but Wilson refuses to recognize Huerta and is very much worried, you know, about, will this revolution spill over? Will it spill across the Rio Grande or into, you know, Arizona, Southern California? But it's things like there's essentially a misunderstanding at the port of Tampico that leads ultimately to a U.S. occupation of the port city of Veracruz. And there are a lot of, we'll come to this point again later, Wilson has a lot of very high-minded ideas of what this is going to achieve. Maybe they don't all come together the way he wants them to. And Huerta, ultimately, his inability to drive the Americans out of that city leads to him resigning, and Carranza takes over. But and he is viewed, at least initially, as more acceptable to Woodrow Wilson. But it's also, the United States didn't land in Veracruz planning to march to Mexico City. Maybe if they hadn't received any resistance, they might have tried it. But there weren't very many of them. This wasn't a, you know, full-scale invasion. They were trying to do a limited occupation. And while Huerta does resign, that occupation is kind of doesn't go well in any other way. It is spun as a victory. But I think it's 7 months of the Americans occupying that port city. And ultimately, its real legacy is that it just really destroys any sort of goodwill between Mexico, especially the Mexican people, and the United States. But I mean, even as World War I is beginning in 1914, nobody, Wilson included, had any idea what it was going to be. How many people, I mean, I think it's ultimately like a generation, essentially, of World War, of European men is wiped out in this war. And at its outbreak, the Americans especially saw this as like, well, I guess the aristocrats, those, you know, interrelated, interbreeding aristocrats over in Europe are at it again. And hopefully this one will be done as quickly as like the Franco-Prussian War just about 40 years earlier. But of course, as time will show, they couldn't really be more wrong.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop for today. Our next discussion is going to focus on Wilson during the war and his evolving response to that conflict. So thank you, Andrew, for joining us today, and I look forward to our next talk.
Thank you so much. So do I.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.